on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. Thank you so much for being with us today. We've got a great show for you today, as always, and a little bit of more breathing room today. We had two or three days in a row where I didn't even have time to do an introduction because the interviews were long. Today, we're a little bit more relaxed, and so I'm excited for that. First up today, we have Brent Rittersdorf. He is a real estate guy here in Atlanta, very, very successful with that. He runs one of the local chamber of commerce type, not a chamber, but a county promotional organization, very, very successfully. And he has just released a new book about purpose. And I love the book. I am very excited and impressed with what Brent has done. Oh, his name is Brent Rittersdorf. I don't know if I said that or not. Anyway, so Brent is with us today. I was actually at one of the launch parties and was very excited and honored to see him talk about the book and hear about the purpose of the book and his purpose on a book called Purpose, like a coffee table book about coffee tables. And then Jillian Riley is with us. She has a book about the 10 permissions, and she is the permission architect. My kids are going to be excited to get in touch with her. Great interview. We talk about exactly these 10 permissions, and it's so fascinating. I was really excited to share that with you. So anyway, great show. We'll get started in just a second. Oh, I forgot to talk about China. China is bad, y'all. Hong Kong burning, 8 buildings burned over the weekend.
The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us today. Very excited to welcome a new guest to the show and one of my personal acquaintances and friends. Please welcome Brent Rittersdorf to the show. He had a very successful career in the restaurant industry and became one of the vice presidents at Hooters, and after that decided he wanted to switch industries. And so we went into residential real estate here in the Atlanta area. And that's how I met him. He is very active in giving back and very active in organizations. He has been the president of the Kennesaw Business Association recently and is incredibly active there still. Just last week, he released his first book. It is called The Point is in the Purpose, How Going 10 for 10 Can Change Your Life. It is selling very well and is very well reviewed on that Amazon thing. Brent, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Jim, thank you very much for having me. I got to tell you, you made my week when I got the invite to come onto your show. I think you've done over 2,700 episodes now, and yes. Man, what a highlight of the week, to be honest. So thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for saying that. That is very kind, and I'm very excited for the book. I actually, knew of it before it happened, and we talked before it happened, and it's cool to see it actually published and for sale now. So congratulations.
Thank you. You did have a part in the book, actually. You wrote a blurb. I think that's the best word to call it in the book to promote it. And you had a great highlight in the book when it came to giving me the inspiration to give a keynote speech. So you're highlighted in the book as well.
Awesome. Thank you for that. That makes me feel like I've actually done something that's moved the world in some tiny way. Tell us about the book and what your goal with it is. What do you want people to learn?
Sure, Jim. I have a favorite word. You probably have a favorite word too, and I'd love to know what that is. But my favorite word is serendipity. I love it. Well, my word's not quite as fancy as that. My favorite word is purpose, which is obviously in the title of the book. And I love that word because every time I hear it, I perk up thinking I'm going to learn something about it. But every time I hear it in a keynote speech, people just assume you have one. And my argument of the book is everybody deserves to know what their purpose is and how to achieve it. But I think most people really don't know what their purpose is, and they struggle with it all the time. So that's the framework of the book.
Okay, so what is purpose? You know, I've argued with Simon Sinek about the word why, and he, you know, totally was unimpressed with my why. what if my purpose is, you know, the thing about purpose is it implies I'm my purpose is to save 10,000 whales and make sure that the crimes of the past are repaid. So that's bullshit. You know, your purpose is to pay the bills every month. You know, why do we have to have these lofty purposes and whys? That's where I get off. What are your thoughts?
Fair enough. I think that's, it makes a lot of sense. In fact, the opening foreword of the book that's written, it says, great, another book about purpose. So there's 1,000 books about purpose. And for me, it's just living a life that makes you fulfilled. And I see so many people that just kind of, you could tell by looking at their eyes and their nonverbal gestures, if they don't know what they're doing, they just kind of are lost. And so purpose is, to me, just how are you living your life? And is it fulfilled? And are you happy with what you have versus just trying to chase something more and trying to be competitive with the next guy versus being thankful for what you have right now and trying to build on that in the future? And I think a lot of people just, they don't know. They don't know, and they don't ever have the opportunity to have a conversation with somebody that just asks them the question, what is your purpose and what does it mean to you?
Okay, what's wrong? Is this okay, Brent? My purpose is to have a nice life and to be happy and to raise good kids and to not die in debt.
That's a great purpose. Okay. That's a great purpose. But have there been times perhaps where maybe you want your kids to be happy and you want to raise them well, and you've done a great job of that. But have you ever questioned whether or not that was going the way you wanted it to?
What, raising the kids and stuff?
Right, raising the kids so that they're doing, so that they're
all the time. Sure. They, I've got two that I'm very upset with.
Well, that'll be another episode probably. But I think the thing that is beautiful about purpose is that we always are questioning it, and are we doing the things that we're supposed to be doing right? And because here's the rub on it, Jim. Purpose in the dictionary just simply says everything has a singular function. So if you were just to take, you know, this phone that I'm talking to you on, it, the purpose is so you can hear me. And if the phone cuts out, hopefully it doesn't, then the purpose of the phone is not working. But with humans, you know, you've got your personal life, you've got your professional life, you've got your kids, you've got your family. For those who are in faith have their spiritual lives. And so there's a lot of different moving parts. So something that should be so simple really can become complicated because there's a lot of exterior noise and it gets in the way. And that's what I try to outline in the book. And I have a parallel to a solution to help understand that and actually achieve your purpose.
All right. Before we talk more about it, let's go back in time and talk about your basketball in the, was it the 11th or the 12th grade?
Yeah, high school, 11th and 12th grade. I played basketball in Maine.
Known for its incredible basketball ethic. And it's, you know, Indiana and Maine right up there in the world of pantheon of greats.
Small town basketball at its finest, for sure, Jim. Yes. It is a, you know, winter in the state of Maine, there's really only two seasons in Maine. Winter and getting ready for winter. So it's dark a lot, and a lot of people love following high school basketball. And so I had the opportunity to play in Rockland, Maine, which is about halfway up the mid coast. And actually, I got a chance to play on the varsity team, but I was like the last guy, like the 11th and 12th man. I was the true backup. And so I almost didn't even get a chance to play. But the key thing that I learned was that we couldn't go home from practice until we made 10 free throws. Not 10 free throws, but 10 free throws in a row. So if you can think about that pressure, if you're on shot number 7 and you miss, you got to go all the way back to the beginning. And so that was how we ended every one of our practices the entire time I played high school in varsity basketball. And so can I tell you a quick story of 15 minutes of fame?
Yeah. That's what I wanted. Keep going.
Okay. Everybody's got their 15 minutes of fame. And so we get to our senior year. We go to the Eastern Maine State Semifinals basketball tournament. And we're playing the number one team in the state, Holton, Maine, which is really a border town of Canada, right at the very, very top. And they had one of the best athletes in the state at the time. We went out to a huge lead. The starters on my team got into foul trouble. And lo and behold, here comes this backup, Brent Rittersdorf, and takes the court, left-handed kid. And when you're behind, you foul people. So they put me on the line. I made a shot. Then I made the second shot. Lo and behold, the end of the game in the Bangor Auditorium in front of a few thousand people, we won the game. And I went 10 for 10 on the free throw line. I made all 10 free throws. And it was one of the best moments of my life.
That is an amazing story, Brent. An amazing story.
Well, it's an amazing story in the fact that everybody has 15 minutes of fame, right? You've done it. And certainly people that live here in Atlanta hearing this story are like, I played on Marietta High School state football championship. That's way better than making 10 free throws in a basketball game. The point is that everybody has their 15 minutes of fame. And for me, I look back on that experience and I was doing something that I loved to do so much that I just wanted to continue to get as better and better as I could and be a part of that team. And something so simple of the act of a free throw was what drove me to that level of perfection. And it really became the framework of what this book is about and how to help people achieve their greater purpose.
And what is your URL?
URL, incidentally, is 10for10.net. 10for10.net.
Pun intended. I just love the fact that it's .net for a basketball reference. I think that's just, there's serendipity right there.
That is serendipity, Jim. I know everybody wants to get the .com, and I did too, and I still would. 10for10.com would be phenomenal. However, 10for10.net sort of fell into my lap this year, and I had to grab it. And it really makes a lot of sense. And it's actually probably even better than 10for10.com.
Well, if you pointed out that it's a basketball reference on a basketball thing and book and everything, then people will remember it forever and even more impact on them than if it were a .com. You know, if it were a .com, I would have forgotten it. Since it's .net, it's worthy of conversation and I won't forget it ever. The next time I see you in a month, I'll go, .net, you know,
.net. Yeah. And that is the beautiful part about it is it's a short URL as well. And because my last name is way too long to say out loud, spell it, whatever. And even though I have that as a URL, nobody wants to try to spell BrentRittersdorf.com.
Yep. That's a hard one.
Yeah, it is a hard one. Easy. It's a lot harder than Jim Beach.
That was easy. Yes.
It was easy for sure.
But I had to buy that and it was not really cheap. They came at me with Jim is the 8th most popular first name and Beach is the 218th most popular word. And so I think I ended up paying, I want to say $2,400 for it.
Those guys, and did you use like the GoDaddy platform? Because they just are brokers. I tried to do the 10for10.com and they want you to pay just to contact the person to see how much they want. And yes, that doesn't guarantee you anything.
It doesn't guarantee anything. So you can go to, what is it? NAIDS.org or something. I think that's so it.
After, yeah, or something like that. You're right. Okay.
And find out who the real owner is. And if it's not blocked, you can contact them yourself and see what's going on. Is anyone using it? I mean, is there a website there?
No, there was earlier in the year, Jim. It was 10for10.com was like an appliance company out of Michigan, which made no sense to me. And then all of a sudden it became available. I got a notice that I could bid on it, but then I had to create another account with GoDaddy so that I actually had the right to bid on it. And then now it's for sale for like 10 grand.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot of money. We have to sell a lot of books, Jim, before we can buy that.
Yes. Yes. What do I do if I don't know my purpose? I don't know. I just got a job. I found the first job I could find, you know, took it. What's my purpose?
That's the big thing. And the first thing you need to learn about your purpose is how to define it. And I understand people go through life. They have to get a job because they got to pay the bills. And so that takes precedent. But when you're thinking about what it is that you love to do, and that is really what's on your way. And that's where the high school story became so powerful for me, because when I got out of high school, Jim, I was told, go get a job, work hard, make a lot of money, and you'll be happy. And that's because that's what you do. Forget about all that high school nonsense and being in basketball. Just go get a job, work hard, and make money. And so that's what I did. And did that in the restaurant career, as you illustrated at the top. And I began to think, is this something that I'm doing that's really making me happy? And so I started flipping the script. What if I could do something that I love to do, work hard, and then have faith that the money will come on the backside? And that really was how I started defining my purpose. And so people, I would challenge, if they're not sure, think about it from that standpoint for a second. Are you doing what you love to do, putting in the hard work, and having faith that the money will come? Because if you really love what you do, chances are you're going to be doing it at a higher level than anything else. And the money will come as a result. But that would be the start.
You would hope. Yes.
You hope.
Yes, you hope. And, you know, a lot of times it pays off that way. A lot of times it works out that way. So
it does. It does. There's one other thing, though, about purpose, if I got time, as far as identifying it, Jim. Do I have time?
Yeah, go.
So you have to identify your purpose, too. And that's why purpose becomes so difficult, because you have to define it. You have to identify it and then achieve it, of course. And I learned how to identify purpose by my dog, believe it or not. My dog, Bronson, he was a Weimaraner. And if the listeners aren't sure what that is, it's a German short-haired pointer dog. They love to retrieve things. And Bronson loved to play Frisbee. And over the course of his life, I figured I threw that Frisbee like 10,000 times. And it hit me one day of how simple identifying purpose is. And that is Bronson's purpose was to catch the Frisbee, and mine was to simply throw it. And when you think about how simple the act of throwing a Frisbee and catching it is, Bronson couldn't catch the Frisbee unless I threw it. And if he didn't bring it back, I couldn't throw it back to him again. And so when you begin to identify purpose in your life by loving what you do, you realize that in order to achieve your purpose, you got to help somebody else achieve theirs as well, which really falls right back in line with you saying, I want to raise my kids so that they do great things in life, because you're helping, they're fulfilling your purpose, but you're also helping them achieve theirs. Otherwise, we just become selfish in our actions. Hey, I want to do this. Look what I did. I wrote a book and I did this. But it's got to be for other people as well. And when you take that approach, then you really start to hone in on that purpose stuff.
How will you use this book in your real estate sales?
It's a good conversation starter, because a lot of times when I go into an event or a networking event, I've got the real estate name tag on, or people ask me what I do, and I say I sell real estate. You get a common response. You probably already have one. I know 1,000 real estate agents. You know, I know a bunch of people that sell real estate. But then it becomes a conversation starter of, well, I also wrote a book, and people begin to perk up. And then when you start talking about that purpose, and you ask them the question, well, hey, what is yours? you can see that look in their eyes where it rolls into the back of their head a little bit, like they're trying to find it. And they come back to you and say, yeah, I really never thought of it that way before. And so it really becomes a conversation starter.
Well, I love the way do you use it to funnel into your purposes to sell real estate and talk about that? And I think that would really differentiate you from other real estate agents who just come on and say, let me show you this house. I got a great house to show you.
Yeah. When I do a lot of networking around the market, and people who know me know that my favorite tagline is, my purpose is to help you and your friends make wise decisions in real estate that produce favorable results. I use that as my point of view at the beginning and at the end of my networking 60 seconds, if you will. And then I use a story of what a wise decision might look like. Like this time of year, a wise decision is if you have an investment property and you're not sure what to do with it, might not hurt trying to list it because somebody else might be wanting to look for a 1031 exchange before the end of the year. That's a wise decision. And so I've tied those wise decisions into my purpose, which goes right back into the book. And ultimately, the purpose is I just want to help people make wise decisions.
I love it. I love it. What does the market look like, the real estate market, for Atlanta? And then you can extrapolate for the U.S. from there. What's the market look like?
Yeah, you know, it's always evolving. It's always an amazing market. And I think that it's our jobs as real estate professionals to kind of keep up with it. Certainly, it's not like it was. It's never like it was 2 or 3 years ago. You know, it's always evolving. But sellers are becoming more educated that they're having to give some concessions right now. Buyers are becoming more educated that, you know, these rates, the rates of the cost of money isn't going to go back down to 2.5% anytime soon. And they start having to think about life, and life happens, right? Especially this time of year where people are changing jobs or moving to different cities. And so when life happens, people are still buying and selling houses. And so for me, after doing this now for several years, you know, helping people understand what the market's looking like really helps them as well. Now, what I will tell you, Jim, is that we're not in a market where, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith are waking up on a Saturday morning and looking at each other, reading the newspaper and saying, hey, honey, we've been in this house for 3 years. Let's go look at another one. That's not happening. You know, people are concerned about their current finances and they're not just moving to upgrade. But people who are having life incidences, they're moving.
Yes. Sucks how life keeps popping up and biting you in the ass.
Life does tend to do that. And if you know what's been another interesting conversation, Jim, and this is happening throughout the country, is this transition of wealth. Have you heard of that? Probably.
Oh, yes.
Sure. It's happening now, right?
And so people who are generation passing on.
Yeah, $80 trillion, right? And a lot of that money is going to be tied up in real estate. So a lot of people that I'm having conversations with, it's like, are you on the giving side or are you going to be on the receiving side of a gift? Because if you are, chances are that involves real estate. And if you haven't had a conversation about what that looks like, we need to have one. Because most people are concerned about today's administration and what's going on. But the next three administrations know that this $80 trillion is getting ready to pass. And if they can tax it, why wouldn't they? And that's the type of conversations that I like having with people.
Yes. Yes. My parents had bought a piece of land on the Cobb-Paulding line, and they've held it for 20 years. And they put a quick trip in one corner of it, and then the backside of it hasn't sold yet. And it's just been sitting there and sitting there and sitting there, and very, very frustrated with it.
Sort of, yeah, like the land
type of what you were just describing.
Correct. Correct. Well, the quick trip probably increased the value for sure, right?
Yeah, it did, but it also helped put in all the sewer lines and stuff that existed. So the sewer lines went in with the quick trip.
Interesting.
But the agent was also one of the investors, and I think he's 91 now.
Oh, wow.
And he just doesn't seem to be working as hard as I would like.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is you want to have people that, if you're going to hire an agent, as you know, Jim, you want to hire somebody that's doing it full time, because, you know, part-time agents, you know, they're distracted and, you know, because they're trying to do other things and they're not staying on top of what's going on. In fact, I found that to be one of the biggest challenges when I was writing this book, is that there were times where I just didn't write because I'm working on clients with their real estate goals. And that had to come first. The writing would come second. Whenever I had the time after that, then I would write. But if I was working on three or four deals at the same time, then the writing could wait.
Well, that's one of the good things about it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It was always there. The document wasn't going anywhere. It was there. It was there. Whether it was one day or 10 days later, it was still waiting for me with that cursor, you know, staring at me.
Like.
Yep.
Brent, how do we find out more? Follow you online, get a copy of the book, get in touch
with yes.
Atlanta Real Estate.
Sure. Well, certainly 10for10.net. You can go there and you can connect with me, send me an email. You can also go on to wherever books are sold, onto that Amazon thing, the Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, wherever you like to find books, and grab a copy that way. If you buy a copy of the book, the hardcover or the paperback, and you send me an email through the website, I'll send you a PDF of the book as well. So, because I know some people like to carry the PDF and want to connect it with decision makers trying to hire for their company. So I'll send you a copy of that PDF if you buy a book.
Fantastic.
You released a book too, right? You just released a book.
Yes, I did. And I'm not happy with what happened in the end. In terms of the client, you know, it was a book I was hired to write, and the client has not paid in full yet. So it makes it hard to promote a book with enthusiasm when you haven't been paid.
I agree. Yeah. We all, and at the end of the day, nobody works for free.
That's right. Yes.
Right. So. Well, I do have a copy of it. It is on my shelf. So I did leave you a review. So
yes, thank you.
You're very welcome. Very welcome. But yeah, that's, hopefully the readers will love reading this book, and, you know, they can reach out and connect. And I think one of the big things I'm looking forward to seeing how it grows is how people share their stories with me, because when they, all these shots that are referenced in the book, they all have names and stories, and I've had people call me or reach out and saying, "Hey, I'm on shot 7, by the way." So it's been kind of a fun dialogue of conversation with people.
Brent, thank you so much for being with us. We'd love to have you back.
Anytime, Jim. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you. We'll talk soon.
Yes. And we will be right back with the Permission Architect right after this.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question.
And that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. I'm very excited to introduce my next guest. Boy, has she led an interesting life all over the world. Please welcome Jillian Riley to the show. She is a founder, writer, keynote speaker, and consultant. She has been spending her 30-year career helping people work on organization and individual change across Africa, Asia, and Central Europe. Interesting there. She has a new book called The 10 Permissions, and it will help guide readers by permitting them to design their lives and leverage the possibilities of a disruptive world. Very interesting. She has been published in the Washington Post, Newsweek, LA Times, and her memoir, Shame, Confessions of an Aid Worker in Africa, talks about her early career in international development. Jillian, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. last thing I would think of is organizational change in Central Europe and Asia.
Yeah, well, you know, all over the world over the last 20 years, I think, you know, leaders have been looking at how to organize people and create teams and organizations that optimize human talent and sort of respond to this quickly evolving world. So, yeah, I think there isn't a corner of the world that hasn't been touched by all the changes we've all experienced, and then trying to consider how to create workspaces and teams that can best respond to them. So, yeah, it's been an interesting journey for me.
And what have you discovered? Is there dramatic difference between the work modalities of Asians, Southern Americans? What are you finding?
No, I think, you know, but probably the biggest difference, and this will not come as any surprise, is the impact of culture. I think the expectations that people have of their leaders, the expectations that people have of work in their lives certainly differs in each country and in each region, not dramatically, but I think what we have experienced in, you know, what I would broadly call the West in terms of the rise of the individual, you know, the expectation that workplaces will more intentionally attempt to respond to and meet individual needs, and the conversations around identity that have really sort of taken a lead in certain Western cultures are obviously not considered as paramount in other places, where people are perhaps still trying to address some of their more basic needs, are still concerned about more material needs over some of the identity issues. And things like, you know, issues of equity, issues of engagement, I think differ culture to culture. But I think wherever you are, we're dealing with the whole conversation of five generations in the workforce and the changing nature of the world and how we, you know, evolve alongside it. So as much as there are differences, there are also common threads throughout.
What cultures have you found that are most similar to the United States, and who's the most different?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, you know, I think Western Europe is obviously quite similar. I'm based in South Africa, and there are a lot of similarities here in terms of people's perhaps more you know, informal way of dealing with people. I think in any situation where the job market is, you know, so tight and people are, you know, really it's sort of an employer's market, if you will, like some of the other parts of Africa, some parts of Asia, where, you know, people are quite frankly happy to have a job, and so they don't negotiate or operate from the same place of empowerment. Those are quite different. But I would say all of the places that have been heavily influenced by American sort of media and values, as in Western Europe, are quite similar.
All right. And you mentioned something about, you know, they're still fighting for the basic necessities. How can fighting for identity find space and time? How do they have time and interest in fighting for identity when they're still not meeting their basic needs?
Yeah, well, that was the point I was making. I think for a lot of people, meeting those basic needs takes priority. And so they might not feel that they have the same leverage in the workplace as somebody who sees themselves as having more options. I think, you know, over the course of the last 20, 30 years in the U.S., people have come to feel more empowered, if you will, like they have more options. And so they operate from that sort of starting point, whereas in other places, people are not necessarily willing to jeopardize their position in the workplace. And so they, if you will, put up with more or demand less. So, you know, I think economic needs drive a lot of our understanding of how we fit in the workplace and whether or not we want to kind of operate from a position of power and authority or not.
What is a permission architect?
I just added that to my bio, actually. I'm glad you picked that up. Helping people to think about the role that self-permission plays in their lives, in their teams, in their schools. So part of the theme of the book is that in a world that's changing so quickly, we need to authorize ourselves, allow ourselves to make new choices, different choices, to kind of drive our own change process. And this is, you know, 30 years of working on change that sort of taught me that the more that you are willing to give yourself permission to try something, to test something, to do something new and different, the more adaptive you are, the more able you are to deal with a rapidly changing world. So it's really helping individuals and teams to understand sort of the role that self-permission plays in their own growth and change process.
All right. Tell us about the new book, The 10 Permissions, Redefining the Rules of Adulting in the 21st Century. I love that term, adulting. My 14-year-old son has a t-shirt that says adulting on it and then the little icon spinning underneath it.
Well, there you go. That says it all, doesn't it?
It does say a lot. I love that shirt that Santa brought him a couple years ago. So tell us about this. Adulting has changed so much in America. You know, people are not adults anymore, still living at home until 40. I feel like we've lost adults in America.
Well, I think your son's t-shirt says it all, right? It's like dizzying, head spinning. What does it look like? What does it feel like? What are the milestones? What are the markers? The kind of classic late 20th century story of adult life, which, as you've just referenced, followed a fairly familiar trajectory. It was, you know, get good grades, go to a good school, get a good job, establish yourself as an independent being, start, you know, get married, have kids. There were themes and milestones and expectations that shaped our own sense of who we were allowed to be, what we were supposed to do. And I think what we've all lived through over the past 20 to 30 years is the profound unraveling of that story. The term adulting emerged in the early 21st century, I think, you know, around the time of the millennials, around the time of, let's say, the 2008 financial crisis, where either by design or default, people were not living those lives anymore. The idea that you could seamlessly walk through, you know, a fairly linear path started to fall apart. Again, either because people weren't able to afford the things, to buy the things, to sort of make the choices that maybe their parents had, or they didn't want to. And so, you know, this idea that we're living now in a very confused time of who we're supposed to be, how we're allowed to behave, what good looks like. These are all up for grabs. And it puts tremendous pressure on the individual to decide for themselves. You know, what do I want? What's right for me? The way I describe it in the book is that we've moved from a world of requirements and guarantees. So if you, you know, let's say go to college, you will get a job. If you, you know, get good grades, you will be rewarded with sort of the best choices in education. These things are now not a given anymore. We've moved from this if-then world to a what-if world. What if, you know, I try this? What if I do this? And I think it's part of the reason that we are experiencing your son's t-shirt, a sort of dizzying set of, you know, questions, confusion, disagreement that has driven a lot of the, you know, fracturing of our discourse over the last 20 years about, you know, what adult life is supposed to look like. So the book offers 10 kind of provocations for thinking about for yourself how you want to drive your own life, what it's going to look like. And yeah, so that you can get more clarity, more confidence, and even more courage about the life that you're going to create for yourself.
All right. Give us one of the permissions.
Okay. I'm going to start with one that might, at this moment, make the most sense for people in terms of going astray. So obviously they're all a little bit sort of cheeky and, you know, intended to make you sit up a little bit. But Go Astray is basically the antidote to the linear life path where you picked a lane and stayed at it. And I think anybody right now knows that that is both unlikely because change is happening. We're living through this moment, if you will, of layoffs, of people having to turn left or right, pivot, as a very fashionable word, reinvention, another word we're hearing more and more of, as AI displaces a lot of roles and people are having to rethink their professional identity. So the idea with Go Astray and giving yourself permission to go astray is to let go of the expectation that your life will be a neat straight line. And in fact, to go as so far as to embedding change into it, to driving your own change and making strategic choices and changes throughout the course of your career. Because every time that you embed change, you make a change to what you're doing or how you're doing it, you learn, you become more adaptive and receptive. And essentially, these 10 permissions are sort of how you become more adaptive in your approach to life in a world that is really requiring us to learn, evolve, and adapt routinely throughout the course of our lives.
Travel light.
Yeah, that's about sort of optimizing for flexibility. So I think the old mindset was, you know, you accumulated, that success was defined by a course of steady, greater accumulation of titles, of, you know, responsibilities, of stuff. You had things by certain times. And I think what we're finding now is, again, either by default or by design, people are sort of having to and wanting to optimize to be more flexible. So if they do need to make a change, if they do want to start something or stop something, they don't want those things, those burdens, if you will, to limit their sense of what's possible. So as I say in the book, take only what you can carry. There might be a time when you decide to make a lateral move, when you decide to, you know, sell something in order to give yourself some startup capital to do something. There's no shame in that. It's fine. It doesn't mean that you are failing if you sort of take only what you can carry depending upon the phase of your life.
That's a real challenge for me. I've always been a collector for my entire life. I have collections of things, some good, some bad. I've collected architecture books. And I have thousands of them now.
Wow.
Where do I put them now? You know, I've got to the point where I have more stuff than I have places to put it.
Well, if it's brought you joy, then maybe that's an okay thing. But yeah, I guess I would also say, what can you do with that? What is no doubt a unique collection to, share it with the world.
Forget about the future.
Yeah. Oh, people get really, really uncomfortable with that one. And, you know, that came out of a career spent doing strategic planning and planning that was always, you know, back in the 90s, and I'm revealing my age here, but when, you know, you the 5-year plan was the norm and the absence of it was a sign that you lacked direction and possibly ambition and clarity of vision. You always had the long-term plan and worked backwards from there. And the point of that is, you know, born of a career spent seeing people not actually use that plan to the level of detail that was always required, get halfway or even a quarter of the way through it and realize that the circumstances and the conditions had changed so much that the plan had become irrelevant. We've always been encouraged to map out a big future vision and then use that as our guide. And what I'm talking about in the book is that in a disruptive world where most of us cannot see to next year, for some people if you've just been laid off, you can't even see next month. It's to not obsess over the fact that you don't have the long-term plan, to allow yourself to perhaps work more inductively than deductively, to find your way one step at a time, to have a big sort of intention, a big idea of where you want to go, but really kind of hone in your attention to your immediate and near immediate surroundings, because that's how you might find your way through periods where you really don't know what the long-term future looks like, but you've got to progress anyway. So yeah, it's sort of a script flipping for the 21st century when so many of us feel like our line of sight is just super short.
Jillian, what do you think about the current 20-year-old generation? As I tease them, you know, living at home, lost, don't know what they want to do, many of them. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah,
do we have permission
in many ways
to not play the game?
I think that, you know, I think the game, the reality is that the historic game, the default game, the one that has rewarded people for generations from, you know, my father and my grandfather, it doesn't reward in the same way. And so, you know, you're essentially not rewarded for hard work and loyalty the way that you once were with status and security. And so I think in a volatile world, people can look around and feel like they don't know what's right for them. They don't know what's good for them. And in the absence of that clarity, they get stuck. They self-limit, you know, they don't even know how to take the next step forward. And so in many ways, I wrote this book for that generation to say, you need to navigate very differently now, right? And you need to move. That's where Think Small comes from. That's where Experiment comes from. I don't think anybody thinks living, you know, at home, you know, indefinitely is a healthy situation for anybody. So I think part of this is trying to get them to accept the fact that the old script might not work for them, that the old game is not something that they're playing, but they equally have to get serious about what it is they are going to do, what it is that they do want, which is why the first permission is be willful, you know, want something and go for it. And when I see people who are, you know, living at home, I see an absence of will. I see an absence of desire. I see people who, you know, haven't named what they want and felt confident enough to go out and try and get it. So I think this is in many ways the language of permission is to say, okay, you need to allow yourself to step back out into the world and start finding your way forward one small step at a time. And it won't be smooth and it might not be straightforward, but it's the only option right now. So it's really trying to give that generation a fresher perspective on what moving ahead might look like that isn't get a big job and go out and, you know, stay in that lane for the rest of your life. It's going to be much more of a, you know, constant navigation process, and they have to gear themselves up to do it.
Now with 30 years to look back, are you a little bit jaded or incredibly impressed with all of the systems and organizational structures designed to help people in South Africa and the Peace Corps and all of these things? And I would be interested to read some of your biography about this, your autobiography when you were writing about this. Are we failing or are we doing a good job helping the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, of course, that whole enterprise has taken a major beating this year and previously, as I think the powers of the world realign and the sense of expectation to the rest of the world has shifted so dramatically. I think historically, and when you say we, I assume you mean the U.S. and the institutions that have been charged with acting on behalf of the U.S., I think an incredible amount of good was done at a time when it was desperately needed, when that kind of leadership was necessary. You know, in my book, Shame, and in my TED Talk, I'm not holding back on what I saw as the flaws and the inherent limitations in the system. I kind of describe it as supply side change. You can't just, you know, drive change through massive budgets. You need relationships and, you know, infrastructure that is there over time. So I think there has been a lot achieved. And I think at the same time, The lasting impression of a lot of that probably will not be felt because it wasn't necessarily building the sustainable change that we would have hoped. You know, I'm not going to be the one to say it was all a waste of time. I think relationships were built, knowledge was transferred, assets were left. There was a lot that was kind of accomplished during the heyday of U.S. international assistance. But at the same time, I think it is correct for us to ask questions and to really sort of look closely at what the most appropriate role would be, working in partnership and working in alliance with others. Let's see if that is a conversation that continues to evolve in the coming years.
It'll be interesting. You know, the pendulum keeps swinging, right? And it'll always swing back.
Yeah, and I was there when the pendulum was fully in, you know, the U.S. is, an ambassador of growth and democratic development and democratic ideals. And we believed that unquestionably. I did, you know, when I went to South Africa in 1993, I inherently believed in the goodness of my role and the goodness of my being there. I learned over the subsequent decade and or two that it was very complex, that it's really difficult to go walking into people's worlds and try to change them. And that's really where the theme of permission and self-permission is born, because I was working in Zimbabwe at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and we were throwing a ton of money at it. I mean, you couldn't spend quickly enough, and yet the most important sort of indicators weren't shifting. We weren't getting on top of it. And I remember saying to my boss at the time, we can give people all the money in the world and all the training in the world. We can't give them permission. We can't give them permission to change, to adopt new ways of living, to really confront deep cultural beliefs and traditions. That is a very internal process of negotiating with self. And so, you know, I've certainly seen the limitations of external change agents trying to motivate and facilitate change, which is why my own focus has shifted towards the individual relationship with self and how you manage your own growth and change process. But as you said, we'll see where the pendulum swings next.
Yes, always interesting to see. Jillian Royley, thank you so much for being with us. Great information. I love this book, the idea. I think it just fits in really well with our entrepreneurship and accepting that you have to take the lead in your own life and give yourself permission to do it.
100%. That's a good summary of it. You're the driver. And so take it to places that you want to go and, you know, learn as much as you can along the way.
How do we find out more about you, follow you online, get a copy of the book?
Yeah, it's currently available through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble and other online distributors. You can walk into any local bookstore and order it and they'll get it for you. But if you want to know more, you can go to 10permissions.com. And there's all the information there about ordering it and availability, as well as the other services and support I'm building out to help people to drive their own lives. I'm very active on LinkedIn and other social media platforms, but all of that information can be found on my website.
Fantastic. Jillian, thank you so much for being with us, and Godspeed to you and your great work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jim.
And thank you. We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. That's what we do. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. We get 10%.